22 million black victims of Americanism are waking up, and they're gaining a new political consciousness, becoming politically mature. And as they become develop this political maturity, they're able to see the recent trends in these political elections. They see that the whites are so evenly divided that every time they vote, the race is so close they have to go back and count the votes all over again. And that, which means that any block, any minority that has a block of votes that stick together is in a strategic position. Either way you go, that's who gets it. You're in a position to determine who go to the White House and who stay in the doghouse. You're the one who has that power. You can keep Johnson in Washington, D.C., or you can send him back to his Texas cotton patch. You're the one who sent Kennedy to Washington. You're the one who put the present Democratic administration in Washington, D.C. The whites were evenly divided. It was the fact that you threw 80% of your votes behind the Democrats that put the Democrats in the White House. When you see this, you can see that the Negro vote is the key factor. And despite the fact that you are in a position to be the determining factor, what do you get out of it? The Democrats have been in Washington, D.C. only because of the Negro vote. They've been down there 4 years. And all other legislation they wanted to bring up, they've brought it up and gotten it out of the way, and now they bring up you. And now they bring up you. You put them first, and they put you last. Because you're a chump. A political chump. In Washington, D.C., in the House of Representatives, there are 257 who are Democrats. Only 177 are Republican. In the Senate, there are 67 Democrats. Only 33 are Republicans. The party that you back controls two-thirds of the House of Representatives and the Senate, and still they can't keep their promise to you. Because you're a chump. Anytime you throw your weight behind a political party that controls two-thirds of the government, and that party can't keep the promise that it made to you during election time, and you are dumb enough to walk around continuing to identify yourself with that party, you are not only a chump, but you're a traitor to your race. And what kind of alibi do they come up with? They try and pass the buck to the Dixiecrats. Now, back during the days when you were blind, deaf, and dumb, ignorant, politically immature, naturally you went along with that. But today, as your eyes come open and you develop political maturity, you're able to see and think for yourself. And you can see that a Dixiecrat is nothing but a Democrat in disguise. You look at the structure of the government that controls this country. It's controlled by 16 senatorial committees and 20 congressional committees. Of the 16 senatorial committees that run the government, 10 of them are in the hands of Southern segregationists. Of the 20 congressional committees that run the government, 12 of them are in the hands of Southern segregationists. And they're going to tell you and me that the South lost the war.
listening to PRN.FM. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, September the 23rd, and Kenyan forces have moved in for a major assault against a heavily armed group of Islamists who stormed a mall in Nairobi on Saturday, slaughtering dozens of civilians and taking hostages. Al-Shabaab, a militant group in Somalia said to be linked to Al-Qaeda, is claiming responsibility for the attack, saying it is retribution for Kenya's military presence in Somalia, where Kenyan troops have helped to drive Al-Shabaab fighters out of much of the territory they once controlled. There are conflicting reports on civilian and military deaths and injuries, but the Red Cross has confirmed at least 68 dead and more than 150 injured. And several hostages remain holed up in the mall with the terrorists who have vowed to fight to the death. Three of them have been killed and 11 Kenyan soldiers injured so far in the last 48 hours. We opened today with a familiar voice to many, that was the late Malcolm X, talking about the identification overwhelmingly of African Americans, especially. He was talking about the Harlem experience, but it was universally applied. The absolute identification with a party that he says has a history of not doing what it is its most ardent supporters wanted to do. And it is a relevant subject because this is something I've been talking about for quite some time. What is it about this community in particular that has such an affinity, an absolute devotion, a fierce loyalty to the Democratic Party? If you listened to the rationale that he laid out, you heard a pretty logical point of view. And this is where we're going today. In the midst of the business-as-usual politics, the dreary world of business-as-usual politics, there is a bright spot today to report, and this is going to be the topic of our discussion. The launching of a grassroots political party that has already achieved a major milestone, and that is ballot status. Is our guest with us?
Yes.
Great. Our guest joining us today is Alton Maddox, who is a person I personally admire. He's a legal strategist and litigator with precedent-setting records of law and victories in the court, the most recent one with a 26-year-old Tawana Brawley case, in which he was able to secure a reversal in that major case against one of her alleged attackers. And beyond that, though, Alton Maddox has been one of the most prominent figures in contemporary civil rights struggles and grassroots empowerment struggles in the city and state of New York, but not limited at all to geographic boundaries. He has a record of defending the undefended, so much so that he has earned the title Attorney at War. And so, Alton, I welcome you once again to Lead Stories.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Eutrice. And you called me last week. It actually had to have been a call induced by the ancestors themselves, because sometimes we are engaged in struggle, but it takes their divine wisdom and spirit to keep us moving. And, of course, you know, I accepted the invitation. I came on today, and lo and behold, you have Minister Malcolm X doing one of his speeches. And it is such a timely speech, even though obviously it was made more than 40-some years ago. It is still very timely and very insightful. And it is something that we still have to examine because you still have the Democratic loyalists today. And rather than stick with the Democratic Party, some of them feel it necessary to join any other political organization that seems to be coming of age in order to make sure that organization doesn't really rise. And so, you know, it's really unfortunate that in our own community, you know, we really, instead of carrying on what we believe in, we also want to make sure we stop what other people believe in as well. And that speech today is just so timely in what we're trying to do, certainly here in New York City.
Well, suppose you expand on that very theme. What is it that you're trying to do, and what does the we refer to?
Well, the we is the Freedom Party. And the Freedom Party was actually renamed from the United African Party, which started in 1990. And then in 1994, recognizing that a name has tremendous importance, we changed it to the Freedom Party. And then after that, we had battle with Rudolph Giuliani, who tried to stop it, and then Governor George Pataki, who has tried to stop it, and other blacks who tried to stop it. So, you know, rather than being able to just move forward as a political party, we've also had to engage in these rear-end actions against other forces that against blacks having a political voice, including many blacks. Who really want to make sure that if you are started as a political party, you don't have a voice, and it would be hoped that you never get started in the first place. So, you know, it's a tremendous operation, but certainly Minister Malcolm X, you know, really pointed it out because our people have such a great affinity to the Democratic Party, and many of the Democrats, you know, would just cross over to make sure that black people never have a political voice of their own, when it seems to be reasonable that we should have a political voice, and not only have a political voice, but also have political leverage. It's just not enough to say I went to the polls to vote. If that vote does not carry with it a political voice, and there is no political leverage beyond that political voice, then the whole matter is an exercise in futility. And so this year, 2013, we are able to, one, have a voice for the political party, and two, hopefully have voices for the two political campaigns of which are on the ballot in New York City, and that is Michael Graves for mayor of the city of New York and Michael Lloyd for the public advocate of the city of New York.
I have to ask you this question. In the name Freedom Party is, of course, also reminiscent of Fannie Lou Hamer's effort of launching the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party.
Right.
And, of course, we know what resistance she encountered trying to be seated at the convention. The concept of freedom and the name Freedom Party, is this a black party?
Well, it certainly is black in the sense that it was organized and formed in the black community, and it certainly has put forth an agenda which captures much of the issues that really afflict our community. But primarily, beyond that, it represents the downtrodden and the disaffected and the disenfranchised, and certainly most of our people fall within those categories as well.
So that it is not, for example, some people may say, well, gee, are they forming a party based on race?
Well, we are forming a party based on racial grievances. And those grievances have to be addressed by the wider population. There's no question that we've had grievances since the Emancipation Proclamation. We've had grievances even before then. And many of those grievances have still gone unaddressed, while the Democratic Party, Republican Party, are allegedly moving into the future. We're still mired down in the past, and we can't move with them until our issues get resolved. And if those parties don't want to address our issues and want to take us to be political chumps, then we certainly have to form our own. And I would just add in this regard that during Reconstruction, one of the major proponents for black rights was Senator Charles Sumner, out of Massachusetts,
yeah.
And Senator Sumner said that it was absolutely necessary for black people to form their own political party. He indicated that although he was white and a Republican, and that there was also a white Democratic Party, that neither one of these parties was going to serve the interests of black people. And that it was incumbent upon blacks to do so. Now, that was approximately 150 years or so ago. And so now what he has said seemed to be prophetic, because we still have those problems, and obviously blacks have tried to go through those other routes, and nothing got resolved. And so I don't see how anybody can blame us after 150 years of unexplained and unaddressed grievances developing an attitude that has afflicted this country for so long, and that is one of white supremacy.
Well, you know, this puts this party smack in the middle of that current debate, and in fact, it has been, and I agree with you, it has been the one thing that everybody ignores, the fact that there is this issue of a permanent prejudice against people of color, specifically African Americans, Latinos, and now even Asian Americans are included.
Right.
The fact is that race continues to be the pivot around which all these things are revolving, and we have historically the African American vote being used. I've said it myself. You know, we do the heavy lifting, and we provide the fuel to warm somebody else. And it's been going on for way too long.
Right.
But I do know that in the formation of the Freedom Party, the concept is, although it specifically addresses the issues of people of color, African-Americans, Latinos, people in distressed communities, everybody could support the party.
Absolutely. And that is absolutely correct. And, you know, and to prove that, you know, I'm always wearing the Freedom Party button. And many times I'm in white communities wearing this button. And, you know, the question comes up frequently, well, you know, what's the Freedom Party and all of that? And, you know, and it gets down to this question that I ask everybody, and everybody has to agree with me. Are you opposed to people having freedom? And nobody says, I am opposed. So, you know, it's a universal party. It has a universal concept. Freedom is a universal concept. And so nobody can complain about anybody that's promoting freedom.
How has the party so far been able to reach this milestone of qualifying as a bona fide party?
Well, you know, going back in 1990, it was the United African Party, and the person who was very much responsible for putting that together was Joseph Back, and that was in 1990, and that was during the same time that I was involved in the trial of Reverend Sharpton, who also at that time was a member of the United African Movement, in addition to myself. And so 4 years later, it became the Freedom Party. The 4 years earlier, it had been challenged by the New Alliance Party, and that was successful. 4 years later, it was challenged by Rudolph Giuliani and Ray Harding of the Liberal Party, and that was successful. But since that time, we've been on the ballot every time we've sought to get on the ballot. And so this time we have sought and we were successful in getting on the ballot for New York City, and we think that we are in a very pivotal position given the fact that, as Malcolm said in what he just said a moment ago, when you have your own party, you stand between two other groups. Now, even though the registration in New York City is 6-1 Democratic, the reality of it is for the last 20 years, the mayor has been white and Republican. So, you know, that means that there's a very even contest here, and it gets very even at the end. And certainly this year, for the first time, blacks would be in a position to be in the middle, as Malcolm X had prophesied when he made that speech, and put us in the driver's seat. And so that's where we are. And obviously there are going to be blacks who are going to try to come in to disrupt that. There are some already doing it, and we know who they are. And there are going to be others that are going to continue that process. But we have matured enough where we do have that middle ground, and therefore be able to call the shots on what happens over the next 4 years.
Realistically, the party being brand new on the scene, it can't, I don't suspect, I shouldn't say it can't, mm-hmm. I don't suspect that it will make a huge splash. But you are seeing this party and the fact that it has applied its efforts, it has yielded a specific outcome. It has actually qualified despite the fact that people were able to challenge it but were not successful in doing so, that you overcame that hurdle. You met the requisite number of signatures to qualify for ballot status. It is just the same. It is a new party on the scene and probably would not be within the highest ranks of the winner's circle. However, it is a positive in that it is moving in the right direction, and we have to start from somewhere. Is that your thinking?
Well, yeah, it's my thinking, and also I think that it's very important for people to not only know my legal history, but also to know my political history. You know, because they in many ways parallel each other. In 1992, I was responsible for Reverend Sharpton challenging Bob Abrams and others in the U.S. Senate. And the reason why we wanted to do that in 1992, because Bob Abrams had tried to wreak havoc on the United African Movement and what we were standing for, particularly Tawana Brawley. And everybody thought that he was going to the U.S. Senate in 1992. And the reality of it was when the smoke had cleared in the primary, we had done tremendous damage to Bob Abrams, even though it was not the Freedom Party, it was the Democratic Party, but we had collected over 175,000 votes. And that was our time when Reverend Sharpton was not even well-known. I mean, basically, I was more well-known at that moment than he was. And so I was able to go up to Buffalo and Rochester and Syracuse and Auburn and all these other places in 1992. And so we continued that relationship beyond that. And so in 2010, for example, where the number of signatures that were required in order to get on a ballot was 15,000, that was 15,000 valid signatures, not just 15,000 signatures. We were able in 2010 to get 45,000 valid signatures. Now, that translates into over 20,000 votes. Unfortunately, we didn't have the resources to really challenge, and we didn't have a candidate who would challenge the outcome because the New York City lost 190,000 votes. That's very interesting. That's around the same amount of votes that anybody who collects 45 signatures can get. And so these 190,000 votes were lost, and mm-hmm. they had never been explained where they went to, you know. So we know that we over 200-some thousand voters that we can certainly do this year if we are not bogged down with saboteurs and other people that keep us away from our goal, you know, and a lot of our own people are so weak-minded. That, you know, you tell them one thing today and 15 minutes later, if you leave the room, that mind go to somewhere else. But if we can keep them, you know, on track, we can certainly get over 20-some thousand votes, which Negro loyalists oppose and white supremacists oppose as well.
So what is the aim this year in this coming election, the general election?
Well, I tell you what I believe. I mean, I believe we win the whole thing because I mean I may be a lone minority, you know, in maintaining that. But that's what I really do believe. But if we are not able to do that, then certainly we would be a definite force in municipal politics here in New York City. But to be very honest with you, Utrecht, this is what we are really doing beyond all elections. We want this to be a functioning political party, a function in the sense that it operates 24/7, 12 months out of a year, and that it functions to its maximum level of efficiency. Secondly, we want in 2014 for this political party to gain automatic ballot status. And it can do that by getting 50,000 votes, which means that after that, you know, you automatically go on the ballot, especially for these gubernatorial races and things of that nature. So while we are in one level keeping an eye on 2013, on the other level, we have also at the same time have a mission for 2014. And given the fact that, you know, in the past, it's been very difficult for us to maintain or start a political organization, we want all of the kinks to be ironed out within the next 6 to 9 months. So, you know, you can only iron out all these kinks if you're fully operational. And, you know, sometimes people just do it seasonally where in June or July of a year and where the governor's running, everybody jump out there and try to get enough signatures just to get on the ballot and then hopefully to gain automatic ballot status. But if we are doing as we are doing, and that is working every day, then we are talking about a fully functional political party. Just like the Democratic Party is fully functional. The Republican Party is fully functional. You know, we won't be a seasonal political party. You know, we'll be a full year political party. And we believe that we need this time and this experience in order to achieve that goal. Because we're starting out, you know, and even though it's hard for me to convince people who are working daily in the Freedom Party, because everybody wants to think more of themselves sometimes than they really are. But the reality of it is that most of the people that are there now are really students. Now, you know, they're not professors. Some of them think they are. Some of them think they're teachers and all of that. But they're really students. They're really learning, you know. And through this learning, the level of political consciousness and the level of political skills are enhanced. so that, you know, over the course of a year or so from now, you know, we will be in a position where we will really be able to tackle so many of the different kinds of issues that political parties really have to tackle.
Well, I've always contended, as you know, that our leadership should be organically grown, because the established leadership is at odds with the demands of the community for the most part. They just ignore the community, or they either are incapable or unwilling to champion that. We also have the issue that you're taking on two things at once. You not only are bucking the established order of the party itself and the overarching influence it has in all communities, but you are also serving notice on the ineffectual leadership of the African and Latino communities. Uh-huh. And beyond that, you're challenging the progressive community as well to say, hey, if you're progressive, this is something you need to get on board with and support. So
right.
You have a three-way fight.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And as I said before, believe me, in reality, those fights in themselves, you know, are extremely time-consuming. And, you know, I think that what has to happen has happened, and I don't think a lot of people understand the significance of it, but the mere fact that the United African Movement started in 1988 and that there were associations that were being developed and certain credibility that was being established, many people who are now in the Freedom Party have benefited from the efforts that were started back then. So, you know, those people have to appreciate things that were being done when they were not even around, because most of the people that are around the Freedom Party now were not in the United African Movement. They don't know anything about the formation of the United African Movement or the earlier struggles of that movement, but that particular movement actually provided a stage for the political participation that is occurring today. And in that regard, when we talk about the formation of a political party, I have created an acronym called HELP, H-E-L-P. And the foundation for a political party is HELP. And HELP means history, ethics, logic, and philosophy. And, you know, and those are courses in themselves that most of us really have never had to address or addressing at the particular time. And so when you look at a political party, the first thing you have to have, I mean, all those four things, and the thing that keeps everything binding together is ethics. You know, if we are unscrupulous in the way that we behave, then we will come apart very soon. So we have to have that ethics that is so important in maintaining philosophy, understanding the process of thinking, and dealing with how we behave with each other ethically. And the overriding concern or prospect would be our history as a people and how that plays a role in where we are, you know, at this particular time. So I think that when you first start the political process, we start talking about how do we develop a political party, it really starts with HELP and a real understanding of those particular issues and that will enable you to raise your own political consciousness.
We'll take a break in a minute, but what I wanted to emphasize, and I wanted to convey this as well,
okay.
This is an opportunity also for our education to understand through the experience that you are detailing here,
mm-hmm.
how a movement grows and blossoms into a political, more than a political movement, but a political party that leverages power that we have consistently lost or traded off, leverage that power to actually improve conditions within the communities which are so distressed. So it is, for the purposes of this program, it allows us to understand how that transformation takes place. And therefore, people, I mean, this is duplicated, this can be duplicated all over the country, this model of making that transition from a movement to a political party that is able to basically command its own level of respect within the political community that has written off these distressed areas, and therefore it can change the political dynamic. As we take this break, Alton, how can people get to know more about the Freedom Party?
Okay.
Go ahead. How do people reach you?
The way that people certainly can to reach the Freedom Party is in terms of, I mean, if you're locally, you know, let's say locally, meaning New York or in the tri-state area, then the most immediate way of dealing with the Freedom Party would be the UAM forums, in which members of the Freedom Party are always there every Wednesday night, and so you know, as a result of that, that would be something that firsthand that people can directly be affected by, you know, in terms of just seeing where we are in general. Beyond that, you're talking about the address of the Freedom Party, which is at 1061 Atlantic Avenue, and that's Brooklyn, New York. 1061 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, and the zip code is 11238. The telephone number is there, is 917-947-8994, and the fax is 917-947-8996. Now, there is a website that we are reconstructing now to really accommodate those who want to go to the website. At this particular time, for those who may want to go to a website to find many of the writings that we have done in this area in so many different categories, that would be www.reinstatealtonmatics.net. But very soon there will be an additional website, but by having a telephone number, 917-947-8994, you can certainly be in contact with us right away. And when these other matters have been oriented, you certainly have access to that as well. But we certainly like to hear from people. And as I said before, we are located in Brooklyn at 1061 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn 11238, and that is the Freedom Party. And the fact that also is 917-947-8996, and the current temporary website that we are dealing with is www.reinstatealtonmatics.net. But that particular website has a tremendous amount of material on it, and some of that material will be moved over to the permanent website of the Freedom Party.
We'll take this break. We'll hear a little bit more of the message that was delivered, like you said, all those years ago, and then we'll come back to your questions and comments at 888-874-4888 with Alton Maddox right after this.
Oh,
Negroes keep the Democrats in power, they're keeping the Dixocrats in power. This is true. A vote for a Democrat is nothing but a vote for a Dixocrat. I know you don't like me saying that, but I'm not the kind of person who come here to say what you like. I'm going to tell you the truth whether you like it or not. Up here in the North, you have the same thing. The Democratic Party don't do it. They don't do it that way. They got a thing that they call gerrymandering. They maneuver you out of power. Even though you can vote, they fix it so you're voting for nobody. They got you going and coming. In the South, they're outright political wolves. In the North, they're political foxes. A fox and a wolf are both canine. Both belong to the dog family. Now, you take your choice. You're going to choose a northern dog or a southern dog. Because either dog you choose, I guarantee you, you'll still be in the doghouse.
You can't get it any more frank than that. 888-874-4888. You're listening to Lead Stories with our guest, Alton Maddox, who's telling us about this bright spot in the otherwise dismal world of politics, where a new party now exists that allows for the participation of disgruntled voters to reorganize themselves politically. And they do now have something else that they can convey their political will through. 888-874-4888 is a number to call. Alton, I wanted to know, I mean, from a personal perspective, what does this do for you particularly, personally, this party?
Give me a lot of gray hairs. You know, that's really, what it is. But, you know, beyond that, you know, the issue of representation is a business. And other communities treat it as a business and something that is necessary, particularly in a Republican form of government. And, you know, over the last 40 years, and I'm not, calling this boasting, but it's a fact. There's probably nobody in this country who gave so much to pro bono representation of a people than I did. And I didn't do it because I really wanted to. I did it because it was necessary. It was necessary because no other lawyer was stepping up to the plate. And, you know, we have in our community black lawyers who only step up to the plate to criticize or to knock down what people are trying to do. But they're never out there on stage themselves trying to confront eyeball to eyeball and toe-to-toe white supremacy. Now, at some point, I realized that I couldn't last forever in that area because it had never been done before. I mean, you know, I know the history of black lawyers in this country from Macon B. Allen on down to myself and beyond. And I know that there's a modus operandi which at some point calls for an end to a black lawyer who does not toe the party line. And so while I was, winning cases and doing things on the legal side, I also was smart enough to recognize that this was going to come to an end. And so, you know, and that's why when we formed the United African Movement and all, we had an idea on political representation. And, you know, because I knew that it was obviously going to come a time when I was going to be framed and just barred from the practice of law, not disbarred, but just barred from the practice of law because of Might Makes Right. So, you know, I had begun to plan that back then, and, we did many things that were very important for that process. And, you know, a lot of times you don't spell those things out, because the worst thing you can do in the black community is tell somebody what you're doing, because you'll never get it done. So a lot of things that we did, people didn't see a political connection to it. We started the slave theater. We brought people in from all over the world to it. That was very historic. But it was also helping us develop a political consciousness, you know. And then we did a number of other things in that process. And then we looked at a timetable and a calendar and realized that 2013, or at least I realized 2013 was time for us to really make our move in the city of New York, because all of the money of Bloomberg would be, you know, leaving Gracie Mansion. And we may now have a chance to get back in. And so that's what we have done through this whole process. So it's a lot of time and a lot of planning. Unfortunately, a lot of the people that are with you would never cut in on the plan, because if they had been cut on the plan, you may have never been as successful as we have been. But this is not something that just started overnight. This has been a long-term process. And we are now in 2013 and hopefully in 2014. And then after that, hopefully it can spread across the country and make all of the sayings of Minister Malcolm X and others a real reality, and how our vote will really count. And it will go from voting rights to political rights.
Statistically, you mentioned the races of not just the upcoming races, but 2014. Mm-hmm. What is realistic in terms of a capture of available votes? Do you see what percentage could you capture, or what percentage do you need to capture to be a force to reckon with within the established political order?
Well, my particular goal this year is 200,000 votes at a minimum, you know. And I, you know, certainly next year, there's a requirement that we have to do 50,000 to become a party with automatic ballot status. And that means that we won't have to be beating the pavement, you know, with a lot of these petitions and all of these different races. And so we certainly have to do at least 50,000. And I'm very comfortable with that figure. And I believe that we can really do over 200,000 votes this year. It just depends upon how aggressive we are. It depends upon whether we have to keep being bogged down with people who want to come in and make us believe that the tail's supposed to wag the dog instead of the dog wagging the tail. And if we can get past those people, those obstructionists, then I think that we can certainly do well over 200,000 votes this year, more. And I think those 200,000 votes or more are going to be very important in this mayoral race.
In this race, we saw the phenomenon in this last primary, we saw the phenomenon of a highly contentious race with so many candidates and a person who was not really at the top tier, just managing to, you know, come to the fore. I'm talking about Bill de Blasio.
Mm-hmm.
How do you position, let's say, you position your candidates against the de Blasios, you know, the people who are in the party but are seen as liberal, open to new ideas about the way constituencies need to be served and so forth? Does that change your course at all, or attitude at all, about such candidates within the Democratic Party? Are any of them to be spared the wrath of the Freedom Party?
No, nobody will be spared. And beyond that, you know, I heard some interesting conversation on some of the TV programs this past Sunday, and people were describing de Blasio. And they were saying that de Blasio is really a Clinton centrist, and that, you know, obviously he, you know, came out of the Clinton network and the whole bit, but he's actually a political centrist. He really is not over on the left, although he ran to the left of center in order to capture the Democratic nomination. And they indicated that his job now is try to wiggle back to the center. And my interest and what I intend to do, because we got some blacks who are right around me trying to make sure it doesn't happen, but I intend to make sure that de Blasio doesn't get back to the center, that he has to hang out there, you know, so it won't be a bait and switch, as he has intentions of doing. And that, and that he's going to either have to come clean over there, or he's going to have to disintegrate, or more importantly, the Freedom Party is going to rise to the top. So I think that that's really where we are right now, and that's the strength of the Freedom Party if it becomes vocal. Now, some people want to be quiet, don't upset the avocado, let's just go along and get along, all of that. Well, we do that, then we don't need for a Freedom Party. In the first place, or nobody gonna get freedom being quiet, you know. And so, you know, this is absurd. Anybody even embrace something like that? So, but that's where we are right now. And it's a really good position. And I think if we can get out the chute this week with a number of things that I have planned, that we can go there. But if people are persuaded that we ought to be quiet and get back under a bush and hide and run for the tall grass as an alternative, this is never going to happen. And it's a waste of time for us to even be entertaining this whole idea.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Alton, for bringing this inside view to us today, where we can appreciate the formation of a grassroots effort that has led to a political party. It says something about discipline. It says something about vision. It says something about dedication to the community. And I wish every success. And, I think it's such a good idea. It's long overdue. And now people have a sense of what it takes to progress. And as you said in the beginning, this is yet another effort that was made possible by the sacrifices of those who went before, many of whom paid the ultimate price in order that we can actually be free.
Well, that is true, Eutrice, and that's why all of our revered ancestors, many of them, are on our letterhead, and we don't intend for other people to come in and to betray their vision.
Thank you so much for being with us, Alton.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.